And now I turn to another book, although it has the same title and author, A Manual of Pastoral Theology by the Reverend Frederick Schultz, D.D. This one was published by the Herder Book Company in 1927, and it has an equal update by Johannes Rothensteiner, an imprimatur by the same bishop, Johannes J. Clemen. Copyright 1923. Reading under Chapter 6, Holy Orders. The Catholic priesthood is not, as infidels and heretics would fain believe, a purely human institution, the results of evolution, the product of crafty and daring impostures. Its origin is divine. It has been established by the Son of God himself. In speaking of the powers of the priesthood, we have to distinguish between the power of orders and the power of jurisdiction. As man consists of body and soul, the body being the external agent, the soul the internal life-giving principle, so the Church of Christ is both a visible society in an external forum and an invisible spiritual being. As a visible society, she is vested with jurisdiction over her members. As an invisible being, she exercises a life-giving ministry. Jurisdiction results with a hierarchy. The Pope is the head of the Church and the bishops in their respective dioceses. This jurisdiction the bishop does not obtain through episcopal consecration. It is conveyed to him by the authority of the Holy See and the apostolic brief appointing him and setting him as a ruler over a portion of Christ's vineyard. Quote, no temporal sovereign or state can give this jurisdiction. It is not earthly, but of heavenly creation. It is empathetically a power from God. The channel of its derivation is through the apostolate. Once clothed with it and invested with his mission, the bishop is the ruler of the churches, the custodian of God's laws, the enforcer of ecclesiastical canons, the father of his clergy, the pastor of his people, the chief preacher of the word of God to the flock, and the guide of souls. All other ministries are exercised in dependence of him. Unquote. Taken from the Eulathorn Ecclesia Discourses, page 103. A priest by his ordination has no jurisdiction, but as he is called upon to cooperate with the bishop, the latter is supposed to communicate to him part of that power which he has obtained by apostolic appointment. We say part of that power because jurisdiction is twofold, in the internal forum and in the external forum. The former, which is exercised mainly in the tribunal of penance, a priest receives when he is authorized to hear confessions. In the latter, he participates to a certain extent after the bishop has assigned him to a regular position as pastor or rector ecclesiae. This jurisdiction is not perpetual. It may be limited or withdrawn for good reasons. Not so with the power of orders. It is received through the sacrament of holy orders and being attached to the indelible character which this sacrament imprints cannot be destroyed or taken away. Only the use of it may be suspended. Any ministerial act exercised in spite of a suspension will become sinful without, however, losing its effect or forfeiting its validity, except the absolution given by a vitandus. Someone wrote here that you could see Canon 2261 to verify that last statement. And now I'm going to refer to a sacramental theology by Clarence Mac Olive, S.J. as it imprimi potest by Leo J. Burns, S.J. and an imprimatur by Joseph E. Ritter, S.T.D., Archbishop of St. Louis, April 25th, 1958. Copyright 1958 by B. Herder Book Company. And I'm turning now to page 300 under the section of Sacramental Theology, the Sacrament of Penance. Conclusion 11. No one except a priest can administer the Sacrament of Penance. To do so, even a priest needs special faculties. We treat only of the minister who can validly confer the sacrament, and the conditions are prescribed for licit administration. Explanation of terms. 1. No one except a priest. A priest is one who has the priestly character bestowed by the sacrament of orders. Hence, both bishops and priests are valid ministers. Deacons, subdeacons, all others are excluded. 2. A priest needs special faculties. This means that even an ordained priest must also receive jurisdiction or ruling power in order to absolve validly. Priestly ordination is not enough. The character of the priesthood confers the sanctifying power necessary for the remission of sins, but not the ruling power which every judge must have. A bishop or priest can receive this power in either of two ways. He may be appointed to a certain office, like the bishopric of a diocese or the pastorate of a parish. Such appointments automatically confer faculties to hear confessions. And I'm going to interrupt the text here to insert that these faculties obtained by the appointment of an office must obviously come from someone who has Catholic jurisdiction authority in and of the church to give that office in the first place. Otherwise, you do not obtain the jurisdiction because you do not really even obtain the office. Continuing with this text then, the same faculties can also be obtained by delegation from a superior, as when a bishop grants them to religious priests. I interrupt the text again to state that to obtain these faculties by the delegation from a superior, the superior who delegates them himself must have jurisdiction and be in and of the Catholic Church. An excommunicated, a suspended, and so on superior no longer has any jurisdiction in the Catholic Church and therefore cannot delegate it to others. Continuing again with the text, but unless a priest has ruling power, he cannot validly absolve. Mere ordination of the priesthood never confers this power. The conclusion then has two parts. First, no one except a priest can administer the sacrament of penance. Second, to do so, even a priest needs faculties. Dogmatic note. The first part is of divine faith from the Council of Trent. And you can see Denziger's The Sources of Catholic Dogma, number 920, or the Council of Trent, number 809. Quote, if anyone says that priests alone are not the ministers of absolution, let him be anathema, unquote. The second part is also divine faith from the same council. And again, you can see Denziger, The Sources of Catholic Dogma, number 903, of the Council of Trent, number 796. When it states that it ratifies its most true that the Church has always held, namely, quote, that the absolution which a priest confers on one over whom he has neither ordinary or delegated jurisdiction ought to be reckoned of no worth. From this statement it follows, as Catholic doctrine, that a priest does not receive faculties by ordination alone. The Council supposes that the minister is a priest, that is, validly ordained. Yet it says that his absolution is of no worth unless he has either ordinary or delegated jurisdiction. Consequently, he did not receive his jurisdiction by the mere fact of his ordination. And part one, no one except a priest can administer the sacrament. Proof two, from the fathers, it can be proved in scripture that bishops are empowered to remit sin. Christ gave this power to the apostles, John 20, verses 21 through 23, and bishops are successors of the apostles. Scripture, however, offers no proof that priests can forgive sins, hence we appeal to tradition. St. Jerome declares, quote, we read in the book of Leviticus about lepers, just as in that passage the priest makes a leper clean or unclean, so the bishop or priest binds or looses not the guiltless or guilty, but as his office requires, those guiltless or guilty whose sins he has heard, and who he knows deserved to be bound or loosed. Saint Dionysius of Alexandria reports the following quest of the dying old man, Serapion. Quote, hasten, please, to absolve me as soon as possible. summon one of the priests for me," unquote. St. Cyprian testifies that priests were absolving in the African churches. That deacons and all earnest were excluded from absolving is clear from the fact that only bishops and priests were mentioned as ministers. Moreover, St. Ambrose states explicitly, quote, "For this rite, to bind the loose sins, is granted to priests alone," unquote. Part 2. Even a priest needs special faculties. Proof 2. From a theological reasoning, the argument follows in form. Judicial power involves the exercise of jurisdiction, but the power to absolve or retain sins is judicial power. Therefore, the power to absolve or retain sins involves the exercise of jurisdiction. Proof of the major. A judge binds or looses the wills of men by imposing or liberating from obligations. This involves the exercise of jurisdiction, which he cannot assume on his own authority. He must have public power. Proof for the minor. It is clear from the second conclusion. Proof 3. From the practice of the Church as revealed by the prescriptions of canon law, the Code of Canon Law, paragraph 872, states, quote, "Besides the power of orders, the minister to absolve sins validly must have either ordinary or delegated power of jurisdiction over the penitent," unquote. From this declaration, it is evident that delegated jurisdiction to absolve is not conferred by priestly ordination or episcopal consecration. That ordinary jurisdiction is not granted follows from the fact that no man receives a parish or diocese by his ordination. From what we have already heard, and with the help of God's grace, what I plan to still put on these tapes is to show us the true Catholic Church's teachings on this important subject of jurisdiction. We have given these various Catholic sources so that no one ever needs to worry or question anymore about the truth that, one, holy orders is of divine institution, two, only those who have received true holy orders have any real true jurisdiction, three, jurisdiction is of divine institution in the Church and is required by divine law for the performance of any action which is done in the name of the Church. Such action, if attempted without the requisite jurisdiction, would be invalid in the case of absolution for the sacrament of penance. The promulgation of a law, the granting of indulgences, the appointment to an office, such as the master of novices, a vicar general, a religious superior, and they would also then be illicit without the requisite jurisdiction in the case of preaching or administering Holy Communion without jurisdiction. And four, let us remind ourselves that St. Thomas Aquinas, the Prince of Theologians, teaches in the Summa under question 17, article 3 in the supplement under I answer that, quote, "We cannot give save what we have in our power," unquote. And number five, ecclesiastical jurisdiction can be either A, for the internal forum, such as hearing confessions, or B, for the external forum, which examples would be the right to preach, to grant indulgences, to perform public rituals of the Church, absolve in public censures, to found a religious congregation or religious order. And number six, such ecclesiastical jurisdiction, whether for the internal or the external forum, is given only by the legitimate authority, and all jurisdiction is derived ultimately from the Pope. And number seven, which follows from number six, is that all bishops must obtain their jurisdiction from a true Pope. And number eight, which also falls in this line, is that all priests must be given their jurisdiction ultimately from the Pope, but through and from their own bishop. And number nine, let us again return to St. Thomas Aquinas' in the Summa, question 22, article 3, and I answer that in the supplement part. Jurisdiction can only be used in relation to another man. Consequently, since every excommunicated person is suffered from the communion of the faithful, he is deprived of the use of jurisdiction. And number 10, from the same page only, the reply to objection 1 from the Summa. Although an excommunicated or suspended person does not lose his jurisdiction, yet he does lose its use. And number 11, those who are excommunicated can never delegate or give to any other person any jurisdiction. And number 12, the laity as such have no share in the spiritual jurisdiction and government of the church. And number 13, Epikaya, in the strict and true sense, can never be invoked to obtain jurisdiction in the external forum. And with that being said, then now let us return to, or go to the Catholic Encyclopedia, where it speaks about jurisdiction, to teach us again some of these things that I've just expressed in these 13 points of this summary. In the Catholic Encyclopedia I refer to is Volume 8, that which has a copyright of 1910, Unique Hop State, June 1st, 1910, by Remy Lafort, STD, and Emperor Martyr by John M. Farley, Archbishop of New York. And I turn first to page 751, where it speaks under the general title of laity. Subtitle 3, as to jurisdiction and administration, the principle is that the laity as such have no share in the spiritual jurisdiction and government of the church, but they may be commissioned or delegated by ecclesiastical authority to exercise certain rights, especially when there is no question of strictly spiritual jurisdiction, for instance, in the administration of property. The laity are incapable, if not by divine law, at least by canon law, of real jurisdiction in the church. That is, the laity have no authority over things or persons ecclesiastical. It is their duty to obey, not to command. Therefore, no official acts requiring real ecclesiastical jurisdiction can be properly performed by the laity. If performed by them, they are null and void. A layman, therefore, cannot be at the head of a church or any Christian community, nor can he legislate in spiritual matters, nor act as judge in essential ecclesiastical cases. In particular, the laity, and by this word we here include the secular authority, cannot bestow ecclesiastical jurisdiction on clerics under the form of an election properly so called, conferring the right to an episcopal or other benefice. An election by the laity alone, or one in which the laity took part, would be absolutely null and void. But this refers to canonical elections, strictly so called, conferring jurisdiction or the right to receive it. If it is merely a question, on the other hand, of selecting an individual, either by way of presentation or a similar process, the laity are not excluded, for the canonical institution, the source of spiritual jurisdiction, is exclusively reserved to the ecclesiastical authority. That is why no objection can be raised against the principle we have laid down from the fact that the people took part in the episcopal elections in the first ages of the church. To speak more accurately, the people manifested their wish rather than took part in the election. The real electors were the clerics, and lastly, the bishops who were present were the judges of the election, so that in reality the final decision rested in the hands of the ecclesiastical authority. It cannot be denied that in the course of time the secular power encroached on the ground of spiritual jurisdiction, especially in the case of episcopal elections. But the church always asserted her claim to independence where spiritual jurisdiction was involved, as may be clearly seen in the history of the famous dispute about investitures. When jurisdiction, properly so called, is duly protected, and there is question of administering temporal goods, the laity may and do enjoy as a fact real rights recognized by the Church. The most important is that of presentation or election in the wide sense of the term, now known as nomination, by which certain laymen select for the ecclesiastical authorities the person whom they wish to see invested with certain benefices or offices. The best known example is that of nomination to sees and other benefices by temporal princes who obtain that privilege by concordance, and given here in the book are several other paragraphs which speak about how the laity may receive certain type of authority from the Church to be trustees and parish council members, building council committees, and so on. But I think the point that we're trying to bring out has been solved. And now I turn to page 632, where it speaks about the general heading of the keys. And I will give this short reference to point out again that all power ultimately comes from the Pope, even the jurisdiction that the bishops have. St. Augustine signifies that the power to absolve was to be imparted through St. Peter to members of the Church's hierarchy throughout the world. And there's more here if you wish to look it up yourself. But now I turn again to the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas, question 22, article 1 of the supplement, reply to objection 1. It is in this sense that some distinguish between the key of orders, which all priests have, and the key of jurisdiction in the tribunal of judgment, which none have but the judges of the external tribunal. Nevertheless, God bestowed both on Peter, as we read in Matthew chapter 16, verse 19, from whom they are derived by others, whichever of them they have, again to show that all other bishops and on down the line derive their jurisdiction from the Pope. And now to give one more reference source to show this point that all bishops derive their jurisdiction from the Pope. Let us return again to the history, nature, and use of epikai in moral theology by Father Riley. Under the chapter of epikai in divine positive law, page 329, it reads, A, the Constitution of the Church. And so far as the Constitution of the Church is concerned, we may assume as having been proved in ecclesiology the following facts. 1. Christ establishes Church as a true and jurisdictional perfect society, a hierarchical society promising and conferring upon the apostles power to be exercised for the salvation of souls. 2. The hierarchical authority was to be perpetual. It was to be passed on to the successors of the apostles. 3. St. Peter directly and immediately received from Christ the primacy of universal jurisdiction over the whole Church. 4. The primacy of St. Peter by divine disposition was to be perpetual, that is, until the end of time it was to be transmitted to his successors. In view of these facts, we may conclude that by force of its very institution, the Church is a society divinely hierarchical and at the same time monarchical, to be ruled perpetually by the apostles and their successors. But under Peter, the prince of the apostles and his successors, and dependently on them. Moreover, this true Church immediately and for all time received from Christ alone its form of government and its entire power, and it can and must exercise it entirely independently of any other authority which is not of Christ. And here we have a footnote. It is to be noted that we do not here enter into the controversy as to whether the jurisdiction of the bishop is derived immediately from God or immediately from the Roman pontiff. Billet, though himself subscribing to the latter opinion, asserts that in practice it is a matter of indifference which opinion is held, for even those theologians who maintain that episcopal jurisdiction is derived immediately from God still say that it is undoubtedly conferred with real and complete dependence on the sovereign pontiff. And as you might recall, when we gave the 13 points of the summary a while ago, we also therein stated that jurisdiction is a divine institution in the Church and is required by divine law for the performance of any action which is done in the name of the church. And therefore, to make things more complete, let us go to what Father Riley writes in this book, History, Nature, and Use of Epikai of Moral Theology, to understand what the teaching of the church is about Epikai and divine positive law. So to begin on page 313, then going to page 314 and 315, we read these parts. Journalee, Shizmir, and Batuzzi deny that Epikai may be applied to divine positive law. Their reasons basically can be reduced to this: the impossibility of the existence of any defect in that law. Among modern moralists, McHugh Callan may be mentioned as subscribing to the view that Epikai is not permissible in matters involving divine positive law. For God foresees things not only universally, but also in particular. The cases of apparent Epikai can be explained as instances involving the succession of law or as examples of divine dispensation. These authors assert, quote, "One may not excuse certain modern forms of cheating on the plea that they were not thought of when the Decalogue was given. One may not omit baptism on the ground that Christ himself would have excused from it had he foreseen the circumstances," unquote. And Rodrigo's discussion of the problem is restricted to divine positive law of the New Testament. This law, he points out, embraces three classes of commands. In the first category, he places those matters which are necessary by necessity of means. In connection with these, no Epikai, the author contends, is permissible. For Christ himself sufficiently determined when the votum may be substituted for the res, and when the res itself is unconditionally required. It is his, that is Jesus Christ, it is his to make available in his own way for each individual the possibility of doing what he established is necessary for salvation. If he had intended to omit some excuse, he would have established these matters as being necessary only by necessity of precept. In the second category, Rodrigo considers those things which are necessary for the validity of the sacraments. And here I insert, for example, jurisdiction for the sacrament of confession. Continue with Father Riley's text. Here, no Epikai is possible. For these are matters of positive institution. Exclusively upon those things determined by Christ did he confer the power to cause what they signify. Consequently, and in support of this conclusion, Rodrigo invokes the authority of the Council of Trent, Session 21, Chapter 2. You can find it in The Source of Catholic Dogma by Denziger, 931. Human substitution is never to be admitted. Either the sacrament is administered as Christ instituted it, or it is not administered at all. Because the power to cause sanctifying grace is conferred exclusively upon what Christ himself instituted. In the third category, Rodrigo places positive divine precepts, all of which he believes may be reduced to the use of the holy sacrifice and of the sacraments. These precepts bind, he states, only insofar as it is morally possible to fulfill them. Moreover, for the most part, they are not qualified in the sense that any definite time for their execution is explicitly prescribed. Hence, as they come from Christ, they lack any limited and restricted formulae. And in the final analysis, it is only by reason of the universality of the words in which restricted formulae that Epikai ever comes into play. Therefore, in reference to these positive precepts coming from Christ, there may be need for interpretation strictly understood, but the use of Epikai is not licit. There is a vast distinction between clarifying the formula or the sense of the law when it is obscure and accepting on the basis of the benign antecedent will of a superior some particular case which is certainly contained in the words of the law. And there's quite a bit more that Father Riley writes here, but it all is summed up in this third article. Theses, Epikaya, properly so called, may not be applied to precepts of the divine positive law of the New Testament. And although there is very much more that might be said to show about the use of Epikaya, I think by now sufficient has been said to show the Catholic Church's teachings on this important subject, especially in this age. And therefore, with that being said, let me try and explain some more about jurisdiction. And because jurisdiction is an abstract thing that we cannot see, nor taste, nor touch, I am going to try and tell a little parable and speak about money, which is a concrete thing that you can see and you can touch it. And therefore, in this little story, we will relate that the money is taking the place of jurisdiction. Let us think then of a true valid pope is given $1 billion. And the pope gives $1 million to each bishop in every country of the world. And here let us recall to mind that the pope would give those bishops money in the currency of their own country, whether it be the American dollar, the English pound, the franc, the mark, the peso, whatever country, which is to say that the bishops then could not use that money outside of their own country, which is saying that bishops have their jurisdiction limited. Only the pope has universal jurisdiction. Each of the bishops then, with the command and the authority of the pope, gives to each of his priests $1,000, who again, these priests with the approval and the authority of the pope and their bishop, use this money that we again use this jurisdiction to take care of the needs of the poor people in their parish. And here then we also recall to mind that the priests and the bishops must only give the actual food or the clothing or the shelter and so on to the lay people. They do not give them the actual money, because if they, the priests and bishops, gave the actual money to the lay people, maybe they would not use it as they should have. For example, a wino would not really spend this money very wisely, which is to tell us that no lay person has any jurisdiction in the Catholic Church ever. And furthermore, all of this money or all this jurisdiction has quote strings unquote attached to it, which is to state exactly what for, when, and how it is to be spent, or how the jurisdiction is to be used, which is, of course, according to the laws and regulations laid down by the proper valid authority. And first, it must be stated here that in certain individual cases of true and real emergencies, when the priest cannot contact the bishop, or the bishop cannot contact the pope, then the laws themselves state that that priest or that bishop may assume the mind of his bishop or the pope and use the money for that particular individual emergency case. But that money can only, of course, be given for the proper type of emergency cases, which is telling us that a bishop or a priest, of course, could never give money to support someone who is going to commit sin with it, as having an abortion, or practicing birth control, or breaking any of the natural law, or to go in and desecrate some church, or to make a sacrilegious use of any of the sacraments, or anything that pertains to the divine positive law. They could never in any way give that money, because it's not a true emergency case in which it was going to be used to go against human invalidating laws, which of course has just told us over that Epikaya can only be invoked in very rare cases, very seldom, and that for only particular individual cases, never to obtain jurisdiction in the external forum, and only under certain circumstances, in dangers of death, to have any jurisdiction to hear confessions, and that Bacchae can never be invoked to break the eternal law of God, or the natural law, which is unchangeable, or even divine positive law of the New Testament, nor human invalidating laws. And now, let me ask you then, if a bishop or a priest uses his money completely contrary to these laws laid down by valid authority, does that priest and bishop not sin in the eyes of Almighty God? Next, we see happen a very real but very, very strange thing. Within just a very few years' time, the Pope, together with at least 99% of all bishops and priests, become heretics and no longer completely believe or live the true Catholic faith. And because they have even fallen from grace so far as to actually work now at doing all they can to destroy the Catholic faith, they each, including the Pope, so-called Pope, take the money they had of the treasury of the Church and burn it and completely destroy it, which is telling us that which St. Thomas Aquinas and all the Catholic theologians tell us, that no apostate, heretic, or schismatic, or even the excommunicated, have any jurisdiction in the Church. Those who are not in the Church, you might say, because of the fact they got out by going into apostasy, heresy, or schism, totally, completely destroyed all of their jurisdiction. They burned it up, if that's the way you wish to think of it. Next, we take notice that God himself approved the valid authority and the laws of his Church when he founded it, which of course makes it sinful to do anything contrary to the laws of God and the laws of his Church. And here we must remind ourselves that canon law are a part of the valid laws of the Church founded by Jesus Christ. And these laws that God approved state that no one can change any of these laws of his Church in his name except a valid, true Pope, and that no money or that no jurisdiction used in the work of his true Catholic Church is valid and legal in his eyes unless it comes down from a valid, true Pope through valid, true authority. God's laws for the valid, lawful operation of his Church also state that bishops must receive all their money from the Pope, and that each priest must also receive all his money, all his jurisdiction, from the Pope through his own proper bishop. The laws also state that when one Pope dies, the bishops and priests are to use the money they already received from him until the time that another Pope is validly, lawfully elected. But, and here is a key point, they must use that money, that jurisdiction only, which they validly received from a true Pope, and under absolutely no circumstances may they lawfully use, in God's eyes, any money obtained from any other source, say, for example, that which they or their friends printed themselves. Which is to say that no person may ever validly and truly obtain the least amount of real spiritual jurisdiction unless it is given to him by some other person that at that time when it's given himself still obtains and possesses real spiritual jurisdiction. And furthermore, Almighty God's divine providence has so arranged things that whenever any true valid bishop or priest leaves God's true Church and goes into heresy or schism, he keeps his power of orders. But, as we're speaking here in our hypothetical story, that priest or bishop, even if he be the Bishop of Rome, known as the Pope, destroys all of his money, all of his jurisdiction that he might have lawfully used had he remained in God's true Church. A bishop in heresy or schism that indeed does everything correctly may indeed validly consecrate or validly ordain others, but he can never do it lawfully never illicitly, because he destroyed his lawful money, his lawful jurisdiction, if he ever had it. And here we know that Bishop Daniel Q. Brown, or for that matter, not even one of the old Roman Catholic bishops for over these 250 years since they fell away from the true church has ever possessed this lawful authority, even if they are validly ordained or validly consecrated. No old Roman Catholic and no one outside the true church has the least amount of lawful jurisdiction. And therefore, as St. Thomas Aquinas tells us so plainly, he cannot give what he does not have. Always remember the key point or punchline of this whole parable. No one can ever print up or make on his own money that can be lawfully used. It absolutely must be given to him by someone who still lawfully and validly has it, and who can still lawfully and validly pass it on to others, which is to say that no one can give or make up for himself lawful jurisdiction in God's true church. And also note that bishops give jurisdiction to priests and not vice versa. And so at that then, how did Bishop Schuckardt ever have any lawful jurisdiction? And how did Archbishop Took or Archbishop Lefebvre ever get it back after they signed the documents of Vatican II, for example, the document on ecumenism? And although Archbishop Took may have well written this declaration in six languages that Bishop George Musey spoke about in his talk on April 22nd, 1985, where Archbishop Took stated in these six languages, one, the Holy See is vacant and there's no Pope since Pope Pius XII, and two, the Vatican II must be revoked, and three, that the Novus Ordo Mass is invalid. Even if Archbishop Took did make that declaration in six languages, how does that give him back Catholic real spiritual jurisdiction? Let me here then try to explain Canon 188, number 4. And to do this, I'm going to simply refer to an essay written by this Benjamin F. Dryden. So a translation of the Latin text of Canon 188, number 4 reads, through tacit resignation accepted by the law itself, all offices become vacant ipso facto and without any declaration if a cleric has publicly forsaken the Catholic faith. Explanation of the terms. Through tacit resignation. Resignation, which means leaving office voluntarily, is permitted by other canons, but must ordinarily be in writing or before witnesses. The adjective tacit, which means unspoken or wordless, does away with this formality in the case of a public heretic, a term accepted by the law itself. No one need approve the resignation. It is accepted automatically by the Church through Canon 188. The term all offices. All positions of authority, from the papacy at the top down to the lowliest pastor, no exceptions.